the clerk wrote this down. "It is rather more costly to send a wire with only an address, madame. It's more efficient to route it direct through the Central Statistics Bureau." Sybil had not been looking for Mick. She had been afraid to look. Now, from the corner of her eye, she saw a dark form scuttle across the lobby floor. Mick was bent almost double, with his shoes off, the laces knotted around his neck. He charged headlong at the waist-high mahogany counter, grabbed the forward edge two-handed, vaulted over it in a split second, and vanished. He'd made no sound at all. "Something to do with the way an engine handles messages," the clerk was explaining.
"Indeed," Sybil said. "But I haven't his citizen number. I shall have to pay the extra then, shan't I? This is very important."
"Yes, madame. I'm sure it is. Pray go on, and I shall take dictation."
"I don't suppose I should begin with my address and the date. I mean, a telegram's not a letter, really, is it?"
"No, madame."
"Or his address, either?"
"Brevity is the essence of telegraphy, madame."
Mick would be creeping to the hotel's mahogany pegboard, which hung clustered with room keys. She couldn't see him, but now she imagined she could hear him moving, almost smell him, and the clerk needed only to glance to his right to discover a sneak thief creeping toward him, crazy-eyed and crouching like an ape.
"Please take this down," Sybil quavered. "Dear Charles," the clerk began scribbling, "9 years ago you put me to the worst dishonour that a woman can know."
The clerk stared in horror at his pen, a hot flush creeping up past his collar.
"Charles, you promised me that you would save my poor father. Instead, you corrupted me, body and soul. Today I am leaving London in the company of powerful friends. They know very well what a traitor you were to Walter Gerard and to me. Do not attempt to find me, Charles. It would be useless. I do hope that you and Mrs. Egremont will sleep soundly tonight."
Sybil shuddered.
"Sign that Sybil Gerard, if you please."
"Yes, madame," the clerk muttered, eyes downcast as Mick sprang silently back over the counter in his stocking feet.
Mick crouched low, hidden by the counter's bulk, then crept off quickly on his haunches, waddling across the marble floor like a monstrous duck. In a moment he had rolled behind a pair of overstuffed chairs.
"What do I owe?" Sybil asked the clerk politely.
2 and 6, the clerk stammered, quite unable to meet her eyes.
She counted it out from the little clasp purse she took from her muff and left the red-faced clerk at his station, punching telegram cards from his box. Mick came strolling like a gentleman across the lobby. He paused beside a reading rack hung with neatly ironed newspapers. He bent down, coolly retying his shoes, straightened, and she saw the glint of metal in his hand. Not bothering even to catch her eye, he tucked the key behind a cut velvet cushion on the chaise longue. Then he stood briskly, straightened his tie, brushed at his sleeves, and strode straight off into the smoking room. Sybil sat for a moment on the chaise, pretending to read a gold-spined monthly. Transactions of the Royal Society. Carefully, with the fingertips of her right hand, she fished behind her for the key. Here it was, with the number 24 engraved on the oval brass. She yawned in what she hoped was a ladylike fashion and stood to retire upstairs, entirely as if she had a room there. Her feet ached. As she trudged along the silent gas-lit hall toward Houston's suite, she felt a sudden amazement at having struck out at Charles Egremont. Needing some dramatic message to distract the clerk, she'd blurted out threats and rage. It had come boiling out of her almost without her will. It puzzled her, and even frightened her, after having imagined that she'd almost forgotten the man. She could imagine the fear on Egremont's face when he read her telegram. She remembered his face well enough, fatuous and successful, which always looked as though it meant well, always apologized, always preached at her, and whined, and begged, and wept, and sinned. He was a fool. But now she'd let Mick Radley set her to thieving. If she were clever, she should walk out of the Grand Hotel, vanish into the depths of London, and never see Radley again. She should not let the Prentice oath hold her. To break an oath was frightening, but no more vile than her other sins. Yet somehow here she was. She had let him do with her as he would. She stopped before the door, looked up and down the deserted corridor, fingered the stolen key. Why was she doing this? Because Mick was strong and she was weak? Because he knew secrets that she didn't? For the first time it occurred to her that she might be in love with him. Perhaps she did love him in some strange way, and if that were true, it might explain matters to her in a way which was almost soothing. If she were in love, she had a right to burn her bridges, to walk on air, to live by impulse. And if she loved Radley, it was finally something she knew which he didn't. Her secret alone. Sybil unlocked the door nervously, rapidly. She slipped through, shut it behind her, set her back against it. She stood in darkness. There was a lamp in the room somewhere. She could smell its burnt wick. In the wall opposite, the outline emerged of a square, curtained window to the street, between the curtains a faint knife slice of upwashed gaslight. She faltered her way into the room, hands outstretched, until she felt the solid, polished bulk of a bureau, and made out the dim sheen of a lamp chimney there. She lifted the lamp, shook it. It had oil. Now she needed a lucifer. She felt for drawers in the bureau. For some reason they were already open. She rustled through them, stationary. Useless. And someone had spilled ink in one of the drawers. She could smell it. Her fingers brushed a box of lucifers, which she recognized less by touch than by the dry, familiar rattle. Her fingers really didn't seem to be working properly. The first lucifer popped and fizzled out, refusing to light, filling the room with a vile smell of sulphur. The second showed her the lamp. Her hands were trembling badly as she raised the chimney and applied flame to the wick. She saw her own lamp-lit reflection staring wild-eyed from the tilted cheval glass, then doubled in beveled mirrors set into the twin doors of a wardrobe. She noticed clothing scattered on the bed, on the floor. A man was sitting on the arm of a chair, crouched there like a great shadowed crow, an enormous knife in his hand. He stood then, but slowly, with a creak of leather. Like some huge wooden puppet that had lain years in the dust, he was wrapped in a long and shapeless grey coat. His nose and jaw were draped with a dark kerchief.
"Best be quiet now, missy," he said, holding up the massive blade, dark, cleaver-like steel. "Sam comin'?"
Sybil found her voice.
"Please don't kill me."
"Old goat still whoring, is he?"
The slow Texian voice slid forth like treacle. Sybil could barely make out the words.
"You is fancy gal?"
"No," Sybil said, her voice strangled. "No, I'm not. I swear it. I came here to steal from him, and that's the truth."
There was a ghastly silence.
"Take a look round you."
Sybil did so, trembling. The room had been ransacked.
"Nothing here to steal," the man said. "Where is he, gal?"
"He's downstairs," Sybil said. "He's drunk, but I don't know him, I swear. My man sent me here, that's all. I didn't want to do this. He made me do it."
"Quiet now," he said. "I wouldn't hurt a white woman unless I had to. Put out that lamp."
"Let me go," she pleaded. "I'll go straight away. I meant no harm."
"Harm?"
The slow voice was heavy with gallows certainty.
"What harm there is. It's for Houston, and that's justice."
"I didn't steal the cards. I didn't touch them."
"Cards?"
He laughed, a dry sound at the back of his throat.
"The cards don't belong to Houston. He stole them."
"Houston stole plenty," the man said,
but clearly he was puzzled. He was thinking about her and was not happy about it.
"What they call you?"
"Sybil Jones."
She took a breath.
"I'm a British subject."
"My,"
the man said. He clicked his tongue. His masked face was unreadable. Sweat shone on a strip of pale, smooth skin across the top of his forehead. A hat brim had rested there, Sybil realized, to shield him from the Texian sun. He came forward now and took the lamp from her, turning down the wick. His fingers, when they brushed her hand, were dry and hard as wood. In the darkness there was only the pounding of her heart and the Texian's terrible presence.
"You must be lonely here in London,"
Sybil blurted, desperate to avoid another silence.
"Maybe Houston's lonesome. I got a better conscience."
The Texian's voice was sharp.
"You ever ask if he's lonesome?"
"I don't know him,"
she insisted.
"You're here. A woman come alone to his rooms?"
"I came for the keno cards. Paper cards with holes in them. That's all. I swear."
No answer.
"Do you know what a kinotrope is?"
"Another damn machine," the Texian said wearily.
Another silence.
"Don't lie to me," he said at last. "You're a whore, that's all. You ain't the first whore I ever seen."
She heard him cough behind his kerchief and snort wetly.
"You ain't bad-looking, though," he said. "In Texas you could marry. Start all over."
"I'm sure that would be wonderful," Sybil said.
"Never enough white women in the country. Get you a decent man, instead of some pimp."
He lifted his kerchief and spat on the floor.
"Hate pimps," he announced tonelessly. "Hate 'em like I hate Injuns. Or Mexicans. Mexican Injuns. French Mexican Injuns with guns. 300-400 strong. On horseback. Got them wind-up rifles. Closest thing to devils on earth."
"But the Texians are heroes," Sybil said,
desperately trying to remember a name from Houston's speech.
"I heard about Alamo."
"Goliad," the voice gone to a dry whisper. "I was at Goliad."
"I heard about that too," Sybil said quickly. "That must have been glorious."
The Texian hawked, spat again.
"Fought 'em 2 days, no water. Colonel Fannin surrendered. They took us prisoner. All the niceties, polite as you please. Next day they marched us out of town. Shot us down in cold blood. Just lined us up. Massacred us."
Sybil said nothing.
"Massacred the Alamo. Burned all the bodies. Massacred the Mare expedition. Made 'em pick beans. Little clay lottery pot. Pull out a black bean and they kill you. That's Mexicans for you."
"Mexicans," she repeated.
"Comanches are worse."
From somewhere off in the night came the scream of a great friction brake, and then a dull, distant pounding.
Black beans. Goliad.
Her head was a babel. Beans and massacre and this man whose skin was like leather. He stank like a navvy, of horses and sweat. Down Neal Street she'd once paid tuppence to view a diorama of some vast waste in America, a nightmare of twisted stone. The Texian looked born from such a place, and it came to her then that all the wildernesses of Houston's speech, all the places with such queer, improbable names, were truly real, inhabited by creatures such as this. And Mick had said that Houston had stolen a country once, and now this one had followed, avenging Angel. She fought down an insane desire to laugh. She remembered the old woman then, the vendor of rock oil in Whitechapel, and the queer look she'd given Mick when he'd questioned her. Did others work in concert with the Angel of Goliad? How had so strange a figure managed to enter Grand's tonight, to enter a locked room? Where could such a man hide, even in London, even amid the tattered hordes of American refugees?
"Say he's drunk," the Texian said.
Sybil started horribly.
"What?"
"Houston."
"Oh, yes, in the smoking room. Very drunk."
"Be his last, then." "He alone?"
"He..."
"Mick."
"He's with a tall man. I don't know him."
"Beard on him? Arm broke?"
"Yes."
He made a sucking sound between his teeth, then leather creaked as he shrugged. Something rattled to Sybil's left. In the faint glow from the curtained window, she glimpsed the gleaming facets of the cut glass doorknob as it began to twist. The Texian leapt from his chair. With the palm of one hand pressed tight against her mouth, he held the great dirk before her, a hideous thing like an elongated cleaver tapering to a point. A length of brass ran along its spine. With the blade inches from her eyes, she saw notches and nicks along the brass. And then the door was opening, Mick ducking through, his head and shoulders stenciled out by the light in the corridor. She must have struck her head against the wall when the Texian flung her aside, but then she was kneeling, the crinoline bunched beneath her, watching the man hoist Mick against the wall, a single great hand about his throat, the heels of Mick's shoes beating a frantic tattoo against the wainscoting, until the long blade struck, twisted, struck again, filling the room with a hot reek of Butcher Row. And all that happened after, in that room, was a dream to Sybil, or a play she watched, or some kino show wrought with balsa bits so numerous, so tiny and so cleverly worked as to blur reality, for the Texian, lowering Mick quietly to the floor, closed and relocked the door, his movements unhurried and methodical. She swayed where she knelt, then sagged against the wall behind the bureau. Mick was dragged away, heels scraping into the deeper darkness beside the wardrobe. The Texian knelt over him. There was a rustle of clothing, the slap of the card case flung aside, a jingle of change, and the sound of a single coin falling, rolling, spinning on the hardwood floor. And there came from the door a scratching, the rattle of metal on metal, the sound of a drunken man trying a keyhole. Houston, throwing the door wide, lurched forward on his heavy stick. He belched thunderously and rubbed the side of his old wound.
"Sons of bitches!"
he said, hoarse with drink, listing violently, the stick coming down with a sharp crack at each step.
"Radley! Come out, you little whelp!"
He'd neared the bureau now, and Sybil snatched her fingers back, silently, afraid of the weight of his boots. The Texian closed the door.
"Radley!"
"Evening, Sam."
Her room above the heart seemed distant as childhood's first memories, here in the smell of slaughter, in this dark where giants moved. Houston reeled suddenly to slash at the curtains with his cane, tore them open, gaslight catching the patterns of frost on the glass of each mullioned pane, illuminating the Texian's kerchief and the grim eyes above it, eyes distant and merciless as winter stars. Houston staggered at the sight, the striped blanket sliding from his shoulders. His medals gleamed, quivered.
"Rangers sent me, Sam."
Mick's little pepperbox pistol looked a toy in the Texian's hand, the clustered barrels winking as he took aim.
"Who are you, son?"
Houston asked, all trace of drunkenness abruptly gone from his deep voice.
"You Wallace, take off that neckcloth. Face me man to man."
"You ain't giving no more orders, General. Shouldn't ought to have took what you did. You robbed us, Sam. Where is it? Where's that treasury money?"
"Ranger,"
Houston said, his voice a rich syrup of patience and sincerity,
"you've been misled. I know who sent you, and I know their lies and slanders against me. But I swear to you that I stole nothing. Those funds are mine by right, the sacred trust of the Texas government in exile."
"You sold Texas out for British gold," the ranger said. "We need that money, for guns and food. We're starving, and they're killing us."
A pause.
"And you mean to help 'em do it?"
"The Republic of Texas can't defy the world's great powers, Ranger. I know it's bad in Texas, and my heart aches for my country, but there can't be peace till I'm back in command."
"You got no money left, do you?"
the ranger said.
"I looked, and it ain't here. You sold your fancy estate in the countryside. You threw it all away, Sam, on whores and drink and fancy theater shows for foreigners. And now you want to come back with a Mexican army. You're a thief and a drunk and a traitor."
"God damn you!"
Houston roared and flung open his coat with both hands.
"You're a cowardly assassin, you filthy-mouthed son of a bitch! If you think you have the guts to kill the father of your country, then shoot for the heart."
He thumped his chest.
"For Texas."
The pepperbox spat a flare of orange flame edged with blue, hurling Houston back against the wall. Houston crashed to the floor as the Avenger pounced, crouching to thrust the muzzles of the little pistol against the gaudy leopard waistcoat. There was a gun blast into Houston's chest, then another, then a loud snap as the delicate trigger broke in the ranger's fist. The ranger flung Mick's gun aside. Houston sprawled, unmoving, red sparks crawling through the fur of the leopard waistcoat. There were sleepy shouts of alarm from another room. The Texian seized Houston's cane and began to batter the window. Glass shattered, crashing to the pavement below. Mullions gave way, and then he was scrambling out across the sill. He froze there for an instant, icy wind tugging at his long coat, and Sybil, in her trance, was reminded of her first sight of him. A vast, dark crow poised now for flight. He jumped from sight, Houston's destroyer, the angel of Goliad, and was gone, leaving her in silence and rising terror, as if his vanishing had broken a spell. She began to crawl forward, quite without aim and cruelly hampered by her crinoline, yet it was as if her limbs moved of their own accord. The heavy cane lay on the floor, but its head, a gilt brass raven, had snapped free of the shaft. Houston moaned.
"Please be quiet," she said. "You're dead."
"Who are you?"
he said, and coughed. The floor was littered with shards of glass, sharp under her palms. No, bright, like pebbles. The cane, she saw, was hollow, and had spilled its tight nesting of cotton wool where more of the pebbles nested. Bright, bright diamonds. Her hands scooped them together, wadding the cotton wool to thrust the lot into her bodice between her breasts. She turned to Houston then. He still lay on his back, and she watched in fascination as a bloodstain spread along his ribs.
"Help me,"
Houston grunted.
"I can't breathe."
He tugged at his waistcoat's buttons, and it came open, showing neat inner pockets of black silk, stuffed tight with dense packs of paper, thick punch card packs in glued brown wrappers, their intricate perforations surely ruined now by the hot impact of bullets. And blood, for at least one slug had struck him true. Sybil rose and walked giddily toward the door. Her foot squelched moistly in the red-splashed shadows by the wardrobe, and she looked down to see an open card case in red morocco, with a pair of tickets and a heavy nickel-plate clip. She stooped, picked it up.
"Get me to my feet,"
Houston demanded, his voice stronger now, tinged with urgency and irritation.
"Where's my walking stick? Where's Radley?"
The room seemed to rock beneath her, like a ship at sea, but she crossed to the door, opened it, stepped out, closed it behind her, and continued, like any gentry girl, along the gas-lit and utterly respectable corridors of Grand's Hotel. The South Eastern Railway Company's London Bridge terminus was a vast, draughty hall of iron and soot-blown glass. Quakers moved among the avenues of benches, offering pamphlets to the seated travellers. Red-coated Irish soldiers, red-eyed from the night's gin, glowered at the close-shaven missionaries as they passed. The French passengers all seemed to be returning home with pineapples, sweet, exotic bounty from the docks of London. Even the plump little actress who sat opposite Sybil had her pineapple, its green spikes protruding from a covered basket at her feet. The train flew through Bermondsey, and out into little streets of new brick, red tile, dust heaps, market gardens, waste ground, a tunnel. The darkness about her stank of burnt gunpowder. Sybil closed her eyes. When she opened them, she saw crows flapping above a barren down, and the wires of the electric telegraph all alive, blurring, moving up and down in the intervals between poles, dancing in the wind of her passage toward France. This image, surreptitiously daguerreotyped by a member of the public morals section of the Sûreté Générale, January 30th, 1855, presents a young woman seated at a table on the terrace of the Café Madeleine, No. 4, Boulevard Malesherbes. The woman, seated alone, has a china teapot and cup before her. Justification of the image reveals certain details of costume, ribbons, frills, her cashmere shawl, her gloves, her earrings, her elaborate bonnet. The woman's clothing is of French origin and new and of high quality. Her face, slightly blurred by long camera exposure, seems pensive, lost in thought. Justification of background detail reveals No. 3 Boulevard Malesherbes, the offices of the Compagnie Sud-Atlantique Transport Maritime. The office window contains a large model steamboat with three funnels, a French-designed craft for the transatlantic colonial trade. A faceless elderly man, evidently an accidental subject, seems lost in contemplation of the ship. His lone figure emerges, therefore, from the swiftly moving blurs of the Parisian street crowd. His head is bare, his shoulders slump, and he leans heavily on a cane, apparently of cheap rattan. He is as unaware of the young woman's proximity as she is of his. She is Sybil Gerard. He is Samuel Houston. Their paths diverge forever.